And then I'm just like vassing up in the mirror. I just heard this bang and I look round. Then this 19 stone, 6 foot five bloke's on the floor. And David had dropped him. But on the way down, he'd snapped his tibia and his fibula. So he'd broke his ankle. I didn't know how severe it was at that point. And I just looked at my coach who stood next to me. I just go, guess I'm in then. And we just laughed at it. I was like, okay. We're like, and then just remember like the atmosphere, just everyone there going, Dino, Dino. And I remember stopping the chant. Like, I was chanting with everyone. I just thinking that must be such an amazing feeling because I've always played team sports like football, hockey, done very few individual sports. I mean, I've tried a lot of sports, but like the ones I was most interested in were the team sports. It doesn't matter where, like that's never been done. No one's ever boxed there. It's my hometown. So I used to go there as a kid.
Not even Freddie Mills.
Exactly. And to have a season ticket at that club when I was 12, 13, want to be one of those players on the pitch, not being able to because I didn't become a footballer, but then to be able to still
live that dream
in another universe by boxing on the pitch. And also the club have been great to me since I've turned pro. I've been done an evening with there just before Christmas and things like that as well. So it's home.
Hello and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Chris Dix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
You couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beating me. He said, well, let's pull you back.
And the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
There's winning and there's nothing else.
Hello and welcome back to Boxing Life Stories. Huge thanks to those of you who have taken the time to give me feedback about last week's episode with the incredible and highly memorable Bob Hatrack. That's an amazing story and one I was delighted to do, as I am this week's. I've been down near Bournemouth this week at Through Dark's HQ with Chris Billam-Smith, the British, Commonwealth and European Cruiserweight Champion. I've always been impressed with how Chris carries himself as an athlete, as a person, and on social media, and I've wanted him on the pod for a while. I mentioned they're the guys at Through Dark. Thanks to Staz and the guys for hosting us. It's an incredible setup they've got down there. And please check out their brand, their kit. They're doing absolutely massive things at the moment. Thanks also to those on the panel at the Sports Podcast Awards who have nominated Boxing Life Stories, this podcast, in the Best Combat Sports category. And that is something that you, the listener, can vote on by going to the Sports Podcast Awards and clicking on Combat Sports and Boxing Life Stories and giving us a vote. I'd hugely appreciate it. It'd be nice to get a little bit of formal recognition for the podcast. I'm not going to lie. So if you could go to the Sports Podcast Awards, go to Combat Sports category and click on Boxing Life Stories, give us a vote, I'd really appreciate it. And something I haven't asked for a while, if you're listening to this podcast and enjoy it, please go and rate and review it over on iTunes. That's enormously appreciated. Huge thanks to our sponsors, Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, they'll help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. But now here's the brilliant Chris Billam-Smith. Chris, great to see you, mate. Last time I saw you, you were at Fight Camp. You just won. You've won again since. But we'll go back in time a little bit to start with. We're here down on the South Coast, which is where you're from, and you're a Bournemouth fan. Were you good at football as a kid?
I was okay. I wasn't ever good enough, I don't think. I had a few trials at AFC Bournemouth, but I don't know many kids around it that didn't as a kid, because we're probably in League, well, what was League Division 3 at the time, League 2 now. So they were quite a small club then and had little trials when I was like 9 years old. But no, always loved football, played it all the way up, you know, most of my life and loved it. But
were you a centre-half?
No, I was actually a centre midfielder. Okay. And then, because I wasn't that tall when I was short, when I was younger. And I scored quite a lot of goals from centre mid. And then I used to get pushed up front, but then struggled to adapt to that and used to get moved in between the two. But then when I think I turned about 16, I started going up front, centre middle, centre back, and I played throughout. But as a youngster, I was always a centre midfielder.
Did you have a favourite player back in the day?
I mean, anyone my age, you know, I'm 31, loved Bex, obviously, until he broke our heart in 1998 when he got sent off. But and him, Frank Lampard, you know, they were my sort of the players I loved growing up. Lampard was always my sort of idol as a kid, as a centre midfielder.
Have you got to meet him since?
No, never met Frank, but it seems that I've watched him on a podcast, actually. Is it Gary Neville's one or something? He was doing one. He's actually obviously got family down here with the Redknapps. They're Harry Redknapps' uncle, so he's down here. But maybe one day, hopefully, get to meet Frank.
Him on your podcast.
Yeah, that'd be quite the guest.
What did your parents do?
My mum was just a doctor's receptionist slash, you know, looking after me and my two older brothers. My dad was a stagehand on the films. So he's, doing a stagehand, sort of does a bit of everything.
So I actually heard this, yeah. And when you say the films, like there's been some corkers.
Yeah.
Like some massive films.
Yeah, there's been some good films. When I was really young, it was like Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which obviously a bit of a classic for some people, which I think my oldest brother Nick was in as like an extra.
So that was the Kevin Costner one?
Yeah.
Yep.
And then when I was growing up, we used to travel because obviously he'd be on films like in the summer holidays in Malta working on Gladiator, which was pretty epic to go and see. Like, they only built 2/3 of the Colosseum and the rest was done on CGI.
Yeah.
But they still did that in Malta. So I was out there and I remember being like in this complex hotel where all the cast and crew stay. And Sean Bean was in our hotel, and I remember literally being sat next to him at a bar drinking like a mocktail, like a fake pina colada. But I didn't really know who he was. I was like, I think I was about 12 years old, 13 years old then. That was, out in Mexico that was. But that was actually for Troy, sorry. But yeah, so yeah, my dad's worked on some pretty good films, Harry Potter.
When you say a stagehand, what does he do?
So that's a good question. I don't know the ins and outs of it. But I think they do like a bit of a jack of all trades, and they're like, if something needs fixing, and then move the sets around and put things in place. And
just one of the guys silently sort of running the show in the background, making sure everyone's got everything.
Yeah, I think so. But like also like hands on and more like a trade. Like my dad can do anything. Like he's used to fix all our cars when we had little bangers when we were our first cars and stuff. And
what was your first car?
Vauxhall Corsa, an S-Reg 1-litre Vauxhall Corsa. Better than the car I got now, which is not a car. And my dad used to do that, and he built like the whole extension on our house, and every house we ever lived in became a building site because he'd be doing it up, so he can do a bit of carpentry. Like, no official qualifications, but...
Can do everything.
Done the electrics on all the extension we did when we had a bungalow, and him and my brother basically built the whole loft conversion, put dormers in, everything. So yeah, my dad's a very handy man and hard working.
Did he have any interest in boxing?
No, he actually hated it.
Did he?
Yeah, so it was my middle brother Ben is 7 years older than me, and he was boxing like in and out of it from when he was about 15, 16. And he wasn't really ever allowed to fight. My dad didn't really let him. And then I started boxing also when I got to 16, sort of through my brother a little bit. Then I met a mate at college and he was doing a bit. And then I actually ended up having my first fight before my brother did. And then my second fight was on the same show as my brother had his first fight. But he was obviously 7 years older than me, been doing it a lot longer. But my dad just didn't understand the sport and what it has given me or gave me at that point, and like a sense of confidence and the discipline and the respect I learned from that. Also, I played football. My dad didn't really like that as a kid. He was very much a rugby man, and my brothers both played rugby. I never played rugby. I think because I'm a lot younger as well than them, I wasn't like into necessarily the same things as them, but I was very competitive around the house, yeah, anything we did, because of them, because I had two older brothers, and it's they were always obviously always better than me at everything because they're just bigger and stronger when I was growing up.
I was going to say, you must have taken some shoeings in your day.
Yeah, my middle brother Ben, especially, he's the one who boxed, but he used to love chasing me around the house and just yeah, dead. I've still got dead legs now from him that he used to give me. So, but maybe that helped a lot in the long run. And he's always helped me massively with my boxing as well.
I think it does help. My brother's 4 years older than me, and some of the worst beatings I ever took were from him.
Yeah,
that's for sure. So what drew you to boxing? Was it just the fact that your brother was doing it and then you were like, oh, I'll go along and have a look and see what he's doing?
Yeah, I mean, me and Ben took me to, who's my middle brother, took me to boxing probably anywhere between probably up to 15 times in between the age of like 13 to 15.
Where was this? To Pool ABC?
No, that was just a random like gym in a garage down here. And the first session he ever took me to, there was the coach, the main coach, a guy called Huey, and he used to train Molly McCann, the UFC, who's now in the UFC, and she was taking like the beginners. So like I'm going like as a 13-year-old, and Molly was taking the beginners, which was me. Okay. So the first time I ever went boxing, Molly actually took the session.
Does she know you? Does she remember you?
Yeah, me and Molly, you know, we met up not long ago, actually, after, I think it was just before Christmas.
Okay.
Maybe, yeah, in the autumn time, we saw each other. So it's quite a funny, you know, this is in a garage in Boscombe, which is not the most affluent of areas, and behind in Iceland, like, it was down a little alleyway in a garage, and we both... Yeah, we started. Well, my first session was there, and she was training out there at the time as well. So it was amazing to little story that, you know, she's got to where she's got in the UFC, and obviously I've done what I've done as well.
Yeah, definitely. So at what point did you go to Pool ABC? Was that did you decide you needed to take it a bit more seriously, or
no? Basically, so I literally went, like I said, a handful of times when I was between 13 and 16, and then I went to college, met my mate Dean Perkins, who was an amateur boxer at the time. He went to a different school. We went to the same, but then we went to the same college, and we're in the same class. Came close. He was a boxer, so I started training with him to get fit for football because I was just playing like under 18 Sunday League. And I started going, and then when I watched him fight, after about 5 months of knowing him, and I just remember like the atmosphere, just everyone there going Dino, Dino, and I remember stopping the chant. Like, I was chanting with everyone, and just thinking that must be such an amazing feeling, because I've always played team sports like football, hockey, done very few individual sports. I mean, I've tried a lot of sports, but like the ones I was most interested in were the team sports. So then I just thought, what an amazing feeling that would be, like everyone for that 6 minutes is there for you, like, because it's a home show for him. Like, then I just thought that atmosphere is like, to be the reason for the atmosphere, that must be an amazing feeling. So I thought, right, next year on this show, I'm going to be boxing on this show. And I was, but I ended up being my second fight, the one that my brother had his first fight on. So that was the main reason. And I just started, just sort of fell in love with the sport from there. And that was, I went first training at Pool, but then I went and boxed for another club because my brother worked with a guy, he was a scaffolder, my brother, and then he was working for a guy who opened his own gym. So I just followed my brother, had 10 fights there, then went back to Pool.
Well, that's great. So that could be like little brother syndrome, wanting to get the attention and be the centre of attention for once.
Absolutely. I mean, as a kid, that was me all over, especially having two older brothers. I always wanted to be centre of attention. So I think that was always the case in anything, but sport was sort of my mode that I sort of loved any sport and just always wanted to. So I think when that chant, like I was saying, is that's, the reason I got into it, is to do with being centre of attention.
That lit the fire, yeah. What were you like then, starting out? You know, were you good from the start? Were you tall and big then as well?
I was, yeah. I grew sort of when I left, as I was leaving school. So I was about 6'1", 6'2", when I left school. So fairly tall, but I was real, real slight. And I think, I remember the first session I ever went to at Pool with my mate Dean, and he was And basically the coaches, we had about, must be about 30 kids there, and two people went in the middle and shadow boxed. And I was in there shadow boxing, and it's like one of the first sessions I've been in, so I didn't have a clue what I was doing. And everyone's like, and then the coach's like, stop. And this is a coach who used to be my second when I was an amateur all the way through. And he's like, stop. He's like, what are you doing to me? Because I was like hunched over. I was like really tall, but I was like hunched over and like jabbing like this and like just real, like not using my height at all. And he's like, you're tall, like use your height, long arms and things like that. So I remember that, and I remember being so embarrassed. I think my mate, who was another, there was about a group of about five of us used to go, like the next day was like taking the mick out of me, like about him, about the coach saying that to me. So that's quite funny. I remember that memory because the embarrassment I had was like no other, because there's like 20, 30 kids stood around watching you and one other person, and then he stopped everyone and he's picked me out. And but yeah, no, I just and then when I actually got into fighting and stuff, I was just tall and rangy. I think my first fight, I'm surprised I didn't get dizzy because I just moved to my left and jabbed the whole fight for the whole 6 minutes. I remember my coach in the corner going, throw a 1-2, like halfway through the second round. He's like, 1-2, and I threw a 1-2 in the right hand landed. I was like, oh, I should probably do that a bit more. But I literally just moved to my left and jabbed the whole fight. But that was very much sort of just keeping it long because I was taller, because I was boxing at around 78 kilos then. So I was in the 81, under 81 sort of division when I went into championships and stuff.
So out of your first 10 amateur fights, how would you say you made out in terms of wins and losses?
I remember my records. I would have been 10 and 8 of 10 fights. I was 11 and 9 wins. So 11 fights, sorry, 9 wins. So 9 and 2. And then my 12th fight, I boxed for Western Counties against the Navy, and it was a guy who was up at 91, actually, my first fight up at 91, because I think, had I moved to 86 then maybe? I can't remember. I think I'd 81 then, but I was like, it was right at the beginning of the season.
Right.
So I was still heavy, and I came in weighing like 87 kilo in a 91 kilo fight, so he was 91, but I was winning the fight, and then the guy was like 4 fights, 2 wins, 2 losses. And I was 9 wins and 2 losses, and I thought I was going to be comfortable. And then I was winning it, and then he was a southpaw, and I slipped his left hand and went to counter the right hand, and he just walked straight onto his right hook, and he dropped me. And then I was like, Jesus, like, what's going on here? It's the first time I'd ever been dropped. And I got up at 5, felt fine, and my leg, like, shook. And the ref, I was like, the ref's going to stop this. They got to 8 and just waved the fight off, and I was devastated. But you know, that was back in 2009, I think. I think it was the only time I ever got dropped with a headshot was then. So it was
So when you say devastated, explain what that means to people listening. Like, is it to do with your confidence? Are you embarrassed in front of the people that it's happened? Like, what's the devastating thing, or the thing that you think that you're untouchable when you go into it? Like, what's the hardest bit to take?
Yeah, I guess all of it. Like, the losing when you've got a competitive mindset. I mean, and at an age where I was about 19, and I wasn't like I didn't have a low self-esteem, but I didn't have like a massive high self-esteem either. You know, I needed constant confidence and confidence builders and stuff like that. But at a younger age, but I started to learn more about myself around that age as well. But yeah, I think it's just that embarrassment of just like, you got to go and tell your mates and other people, because no one was watching those shows. They're always behind closed doors, dinner shows. I don't know what it is. I guess I put the pressure on myself, and then it's a guy who's not meant to do much because he was 2 wins and 2 losses. And I always wanted to like fight him again, but at the end of that season, I think he was 33 and I was like 19 when I boxed him, and that was at the time, 33 was the last year he was allowed to box. So yeah, I think that devastation is just, you just put so much into it. It became my life, boxing. You know, I took it very seriously, even though I was an amateur, hadn't won anything at that stage. So, but it meant, it just became my world. So then when you lose, and in the fashion I lost in, you know, getting stopped. And I think that's the biggest thing is the way you lose causes the devastation.
At what point did you go to Australia?
I was young then. I was in Australia when I was 11. So, okay. Yeah, parents took me out of school for a year, which was, you know, a dream as an 11-year-old kid. And we went traveling around Australia.
Do you remember that stuff?
Yeah, I've got a really good memory, actually. And my, like, I could probably name the first... I used to be able to name, like, every stop we went on when I was, like, 12, 13. Yeah. I was like sure of it. I was doing a journal as well when I was out there, so I probably got that somewhere. But doing like a daily diary when I was out there. But yeah, we travelled up the West Coast and then went all the way across to like surfers. Just travelled down the East Coast, inland, everything. And yeah, it was an amazing time, but it took me away from sport because I played football up to then, and then I didn't play football for 8 months, and then sort of came back. I put on a bit of weight because although I was busy, I was cycling a lot and stuff like that, I was only eating, like, I was a real fussy eater as a kid, so I was like eating chips, steak pies, cheese toasties. That was the only three things I'd eat, literally, and then pasta occasionally. But yeah, out there it was just as they got a company called Jester's Pies, I don't know if they're still going, this is 20 years ago, so they used to do like, I used to have like a savory pie and then like a custard pie with something. Yeah, I used to live off those. But obviously, I wasn't playing as much sport. I was literally had a BMX out there and I'd just cycle that round and that was it. Obviously, a lot of surfing and swimming and stuff in the sea, like bodyboarding as well, which was amazing. But experience-wise, it's best experience of my life, probably, I guess. Like, I wish I could relive it now or just watch a film of it at least, like, relive it back. But it's crazy to think. Like, it just seemed normal at the time because I was 11. I didn't really.
So, did they take you out to go there because of your dad's work? Or did they
No,
take
my dad just... and my mum took the year off. So, we downsized the house. We were in quite a good, decent sized house, like a four bed, which my dad had turned into a five bed because he'd done a loft conversion on that as well. The house price had gone up a little bit. So, then they downsized the house, and with the money, the profit from the house sort of went around traveling around Australia. My brothers had just left. One was 17, one was 19. Probably wasn't really sure what they wanted to do with their lives. So I think my parents sort of took them away to try and travel with them a bit. So they stayed with us for the first 3 months, then went off on their own. When one turned 18, one turned 20.
Oh, wow. So as good as the experience was for you, it's better for them.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So I was the... probably the burden of the trip, to be honest, but it was amazing for me. You know, we had a Toyota Land Cruiser, which we towed a trailer tent. So we just have a trailer behind and we just fold the trailer out to sleep in every night. So I was literally on a bed, which was made out of like a proper camp bed. So just a little fold out wire legs. And it was tiny. I mean, if I laid on it now, it'd probably break, it was amazing experience, traveling all around Australia in campsites and now and again, just randomly and in spots that we found and stuff. So yeah, it was a surreal experience. Probably could make a film out of the year. Do you know what I mean? It was amazing because we saw, you know, more of Australia than most Australians have seen.
Yeah, sure. Back over here in the ABAs, you boxed in several ABAs. You hit the finals in 2013 and 2016 and you lost to good guys, so Jack Massey and Siobhan Clark, who've gone on to have, you know, good careers. Good memories of the ABAs or heartbreaking memories of the ABAs?
I the first time I went in them, I just won the novices. I won the novice championships early 2011. They were meant to be end of 2010, but the snowstorm cancelled them. So they had them in January 2011. And... I won them, went straight in the ABAs, won the first round against a kid from Western Counties who had only had the same amount of fights as I had. It was my first 3-3s, so that was all right because he did, it was his first 3-3s. Then in the second fight, I went in with a guy called Marley Churcher who had won loads of things as a junior, Tri-Nations Gold and stuff, but had put on loads of weight and shouldn't have been boxing at that weight, basically. But he'd had 51 fights going in and I'd had 15 going into the fight. So I was in my head, I'm building this guy up. Three Nations Gold, saw him on the scales and I was like, looks a bit overweight, like should probably be a middle or a light heavyweight. This is at 86 kilos, so cruiserweight. in the amateurs. And then I was so, like, went into the fight. It's a point scoring system, and I was 18-3 up after the first round, 30-12 up after the second. And then in the third round, I was bloated because I just put everything into it. I was completely gone and, like, just mustering up as much energy as I could. But I got a count because he hit me with a left hook, which I caught, but I just stumbled across the ring because I was so tired. I ended up winning 38-28, but in that fight, I broke my hand. So I was meant to go into the quarterfinals the week after, but I couldn't because I broke my hand. I put it in ice, didn't really notice it broke, and then it just ballooned up. And I was devastated then, but I just won the novices the same season, gone straight in the ABAs. So the confidence was high because I hadn't actually lost a fight in that boxing season. But then, so then eventually went in the ABAs and kept going in them and getting through Western Counties and chipping away quarterfinals and semifinals and got to the final in 2013 against Jack Massey. But I love those days. The memories of those days are amazing because travelling with just you and your coach, just me and my amateur coach called Neil Partridge, who's still at Poole ABC now. He's the head coach there. He was like a second dad to me because my passion was boxing and everything was, you know, everything. We were travelling together on weekends. Sometimes we'd have to stay over. So that first ABA final, we were in Newcastle. It was in Sunderland or somewhere near Sunderland. So we flew up to Newcastle, stayed there the night before and the night of the fight. And even the fight itself, I was pleased with how I boxed. Thought I'd won the fight. And a lot of people there, I remember getting like a handshake off Rob McCracken at the time, who was obviously head of GB, and him going, great fight, well done. A guy grabbed me at ringside who sat next to a judge going, you were effing Rob there, mate, and things like that. So that's that. But look, I was just pleased with how I box, and it's amateur boxing. You've got 9 minutes to do all you can, and it wasn't to be then. So, but good memories all round, travelling up and down the country of the ABAs, just...
So in 2016 then, did you think that was your year?
Yeah, I did, but I'd just come out of 2015, I had shoulder surgery. Had one fight in 2015, no, two fights, end of 2015 after rehabbing my shoulder, then went straight in the ABAs. I think I got a buy through to the quarters.
This is now at 91 as opposed to 86.
91,
well.
Yeah. So this is at 91 kilos. And I think I got a buy through because there was no one in Western Counties, I don't think, in 2016. And then, but in the going back a bit, in 2013, in the semifinals, I beat Ricardo Slew. And he won them in 2015, but I was out injured. So I'd beaten the previous year's winner. And that was frustrating to watch. But, you know, all respect to him for winning it, but it was hard knowing that you'd beaten the previous year's winner. Sure. So the belief was there because I'd beaten last year's winner. He lost earlier on, got by to the quarters, and then it was boxing 3 times in 3 days. And yeah, I thought that was going to be my year. Didn't really know much of anyone going in other than there was Natty from the Army. And he'd come down from super heavyweight. He got to the final the year before. And then Chevron Clark, I knew he'd come up from 81 because he used to knock out a lot of people at 81. And then he ended up knocking Natty out in the semi-final. I remember waiting for the fight to end, warming up, watching their fight. And, you know, he flattened Natty. But big punches never bothered me, like... Watching people get knocked out never scared me in the sense of like, God, he's going to absolutely annihilate me or anything like that. I was just always confident in my ability. And we had a good fight in the final. Close one. He was the aggressor and it was sort of the 10-9 system had come in, 10-point mass system. He was the aggressor, although I was landing a lot of clean shots and that's the way it goes. But like I said, as an amateur, that was my style, was very much boxer move. But yeah, good memories again. I love that was in Echo Arena and I loved the whole experience.
You boxed for England, but you never got selected by Team GB. I did read that really affected you, whether it was, I don't know necessarily it was confidence, but you were hacked off by it and you kind of wanted to get those Team GB stripes before turning pro, and it never happened.
Yeah, I mean, as an amateur, the Olympics is the ultimate goal. My injury sort of put me back a year for selection for 2016. Maybe I wouldn't have been good enough anyway. Obviously, Lawrence went. But, you know, I believed I'd get there. But then the injury set me back. The year I got to the final in 2016 against Chev, we had three assessments, me, him, and the Scottish lad called Scott Forrest. They'd both boxed each other and had a win against each other. Or I think at this point, maybe Scott had beaten Chev. But then Chev had beaten me. But then I'd spar Scott, and I felt really comfortable against Scott. So it was like a triangle. But because I hadn't fought Scott and beaten him, I think that sort of let me down in terms of getting selection, because they'd beaten each other, or Scott had beaten Chev and Chev had beaten me, but I didn't have a chance to beat Scott to sure. make it sort of a triangle or get us all selected or however it works. So yeah, in December 2016, that would have been a found out I didn't get on. Literally a week before Christmas, I think it was the 18th of December. I was gutted. Didn't have a clue what I was going to do. I was like, oh, I'm going to do one more ABAs and turn pro. I was gutted by that.
So, despite not being an especially decorated amateur, obviously a very solid career, you went to try out with Shane McGuigan. And I mean, I suppose there's two things. Why did you want to train with Shane? And what did you bring that made him think, yeah, there's something here. Okay, I'll spend my time on this sort of relatively raw or certainly not an Olympian guy who wants to make a go of it in the pros.
Yeah, I think at that point I'd been the least decorated amateur Shane ever took on, or least, you know, no hype behind me or
credentials
anything.
Credentials or whatever, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
But what was your amateur record? It was like 30?
I think I had 31 wins, 12 losses.
Yep.
So it was like 75%. But I'd been sparring George for about 14 months, about 16 months by the time I'd asked Shane.
So George had been using you for sparring in Shane's gym?
Yeah, and every time they asked me, I never said no. You know, there was one time he texted me on, his old S&C coach texted me on New Year's Eve at 6:30, and luckily I didn't drink, so I was with my wife, she was my girlfriend at the time, and we were around her friends. I was like, I've just got a text, I've got a spa tomorrow at 12. She was like, all right, we won't have a massively late one. She was drinking and stuff, but we won't have a massively late one, and we'll travel up tomorrow together, because she'd never been with me. But because it was New Year's Day, I was like, and George's old gym in Hammersmith was right near Westfield, so I thought, cool, I'll take her there after, and that can be my way of getting her up there to come with me. I'd sparred. I never said no. I had to cancel work sometimes and stuff like that, so I think that helped me in terms of like not letting them down for sparring.
So what did Mia make of that first spar then?
Yeah, she loved it. Like she was.
That was. Do you know where I'm going with that? Do you know where I'm going with that question? Do you think Shane might have given me some information there?
Yeah. So, well, Mia liked it. I don't know how much George. I think the first spar, I think we went in the gym and George was like, "Can you ask her to leave?" I assume that's where you're going with it. Yeah. So yeah, he's like, "Can you ask her to leave?" And Shane like apparently looked around and said, like, Shane obviously told me this after I joined and was like, what? Like, it's New Year's Day, mate. Like, it's come up on New Year's Day. And he's like, just because George had a rule of not letting any women in the gym, because his wife didn't, he didn't want his wife there, and he didn't want
other. If that applies to him, it applies to everyone.
Basically, yeah. So George didn't like having, you know, his wife in the gym, which is fair enough. So he didn't want anyone's wife in the gym, because then it's like different rules. And he'd probably get an earful when he got home. So, so basically he allowed it for the day. So it was a good experience for me.
Why did you pick Shane then? Obviously, had he helped you a little bit during those spars and given you advice that you'd been able to use and that sort of stuff? And you were thinking, yeah, this is part, you know, this is a camp I want to be part of? Or
yeah, and also the summer before I asked him, I had my first GB assessment after the ABAs, and I'd been sparring George for about six months, and I think I'd sparred David once or twice by then as well. Because I had a GB assessment, my gym used to close between May and August, but I had a GB assessment in July. So I was like, can I come up and train for a week? Just thought, why not? I'll ask. I was like, obviously, if you want paying or anything, I'm happy to pay you. But I was just wondering if I'd be able to come train because my amateur gym's closed, and he allowed me to. So I stayed at my auntie's, who lives in South London, traveled to Vauxhall because they're training at David's gym at the time, and trained there for a week, which was a great experience. A week before my my GB assessment, obviously helped me because I got invited back after that as well. And also, I saw the work he was doing with George, who at the time was my favourite fighter. You know, George was always my favourite fighter when I was an amateur. Frampton, obviously, and then Josh Taylor was coming through. And I just loved the way he worked, and it made sense to me. Although I boxed a lot different to how I thought I was going to. I used to watch him on the pads of Frampton. I used to love it, the intensity, the work rate, because that's what I was like as an amateur. Obviously, Shane's developed me a lot differently. I've still got the work rate and the intensity as a cruiserweight, but there's less work because I'm not a super bantam, more a featherweight, where I'm trying to throw 120 punches around. So, but I just loved what he did. But also, there was not any boxing coaches around here. Shane was the only coach that I had contact with that had trained a world champion, or multiple world champions or anything like that. And so I just thought, I'll start at the top and I'll work my way down. So I asked Shane. I was going to ask him the Monday after the Bellew Hay fight, because I thought Hay was going to win. And then he obviously didn't win. So I left it a week and asked him then, and he took me on. But I think I was a personal trainer at the time as well, so I think I was meant to work as a personal trainer at the gym too, as well alongside my boxing. So
right.
I think that was half the reason they took me on as well, but okay. I didn't end up actually working as a personal trainer.
You mentioned David a few times there, so you obviously sparred David Hay a few times back in the day. Shane did say that you'd done well with David. What do you remember about those spars?
I think David liked me because he was obviously a reaction base fighter. Everything was slipping and moving and pulling and stuff, so it was all quick, and I had quick hands, so he used me for that. And then he didn't throw too much back. I think most of it was that sort of just trying to get his reactions in. But then the last time I sparred him, Shane wasn't there. He was in America with Frampton, and I was there, my amateur coach, and we were sparring, and he hit me with like a left hook. And I was like, not like totally buzzed, but I was like, well, they're good shots. So then my head guard had come down, so I'd gone back to the corner. I was like, oh, yeah, can you just do my head? Well, like, my coach's like, no, I can't. I was like, just do it up, it's undone. He's like, no, it's ripped. And it actually torn the back of my head guard, the seam had ripped open, and there was about an inch left of the seam. So that's one of the memories I got. We got him to tape it. We taped it up and got him to sign it, so my coaches got it at his place. But the first time I ever sparred, I went up there and he was sparring another guy who was about 18, 19 stone, 6'5". And I was in second, just for speed work. And then I'm just like vassing up in the mirror. I just heard this bang, and I look round. Than this 19 stone, 6'5" bloke's on the floor. And David had dropped him, but on the way down he'd snapped his tibia and his fibula, so he'd broke his ankle. I didn't know how severe it was at that point, and I just looked at my coach who stood next to me. I just go, guess I'm in then. And we just laughed at it. I was like, okay, like, it sort of, you know, I was, as if I wasn't worried enough about sparring a former cruiserweight and heavyweight champion of the world, he's just dropped some 19 stone, 6'5" bloke. And I was just like, okay, right, I'm in for it here. But like I said, David very much sort of used me for his speed and stuff like that.
The George stuff is interesting because you come across as someone who's quite, I don't know, just a straight shooter, straight guy. And George he sees things alternatively, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And he comes at things from a different way. And we've both obviously recorded podcasts with him, and he thinks and sees things very differently, which is, you know, for me, I think it's a fantastic and an enthralling quality. But when you talk about him being a favourite fighter, back in those days when you have him and De Gale and, you know, him and Froch and all the rest of it, he was a Marmite character. So what appealed to you? Was it the fact that he was different to the norm and not really a conformist?
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, he was an exciting fighter. Mm. We definitely didn't box similar at the time. You know, now I like to try and do things that George has done throughout his career and work for him, and he's also given me tips throughout my career. But he always spoke about boxing when he was in his press conferences and stuff like that. He never spoke personally too much about how people looked, how they did this, especially in the first Froch build up. That for me was, he just said Froch does this wrong, and he was just stating what he thought were facts about Froch's ability and his lack of footwork or whatever he was saying. And everyone would hate that because it was personal, and it's more personal than actually saying how someone looks, because it's about the thing they're good at. So I loved that, but I truly believe that George was just saying it because, one, he's trying to get in their head, obviously, but two, he's trying to state their, you know, the negative qualities of their boxing and their weaknesses and things like that. And for me, that just, like, it wasn't bad mouthing in the sense of I'm going to knock you out or I'm this and that. It was like specific, and it was also done in an intelligent way. And I like that side of George. He's got that intelligence you rarely see in boxers' press conferences. The way he, you know, talks, he's quite articulate in the way.
Cerebral, isn't he? Yeah, for sure.
Exactly. So I think that I warmed to that, and I liked it because it was different, and it was almost different to a lot of people's stories in boxing, because it wasn't just a hard upbringing story about this, that, and it was just, he just loved to fight, and he obviously, like I said, with the press conference stuff, I really liked the way he went about it.
So did it make you anti-Froch or anti-De Gale in those rivalries, the fact that you were, you know, that you were at your height of fandom as a teenager?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that wasn't even a teenager. That was maybe late teens, early 20s, but I would have been 21, no, 20 when George boxed De Gale, and I went to that fight. Got tickets off Bradley Skeet because he was meant to be on the bill, but he was a live swing and never got on. Obviously, Cleverly was meant to fight Bramer, I think.
That's
then.
Right, yeah.
Bramer pulled out 3 days' notice and
covered that for that show.
Yeah, so they ended up headlining. I would say I was definitely anti De Gale because of the build up and everything. And
you pick your side, yeah.
The ringside's classic, isn't it? Of them two together. And George, he's like, if you're a betting man, put your money on it. And George stands up and puts his hands out like, I'll put my money on it. Like, and then James just told him to sit down because of his tie. Like, it was just like the mind games behind it. I loved that, like, George just clearly was winning even if he didn't have a great tie on. But yeah, I thought, like, that's all that James had, is just that had to get personal and try and base it on looks, and it was just different to how George. So I guess I was kind of anti De Gale. I'm not,
no,
you know,
no,
I don't yeah. hate anyone, like, in rivalries like that. I think Froch as well. I was during the build up and the fights. But then if Froch had boxed somebody else, I probably would have been a fan. I was a big fan of Froch until the sort of George build up, really, because I thought he changed slightly as a character and things like that, as opposed to how he used to be. Maybe I just saw it from a different angle, but no, I think, and now obviously George and Carl are friends themselves. So
yeah. So in 2017, you made your debut in Bournemouth, and, you know, just reading the report of that fight recently, you had hundreds of fans there, cheering your name and all the rest of it. So in many ways, that was the dream realised.
Yeah.
Although I suppose you'd had that as an amateur as well. But like,
to be honest, as an amateur, I never took a huge fan base anywhere, and I didn't box in Bournemouth. I did last year as an amateur. I did have a good show at home show where it was a decent turnout. But yeah, it was the it was at the O2 Academy locally, which I've been to loads of gigs at before. They used to have an under-18s night there when I was like 13, 14 that I used to go. I probably had my first kiss there, for example, and then I'm having my debut there. And I've been there hundreds of times. My brothers used to go there when there was raves there and stuff like that. So it was fitting that it was where it was. It was probably a mile and a half away, maybe 2 miles from the house I grew up in. It's less than half a mile away from my mum's current flat where she lives. And did at the time of the debut, so it's it was a fitting venue, and it was an amazing atmosphere. Yeah,
what I mean, this is a different question obviously now that you're British Commonwealth and European champion, but what was the dream then? Like, was it, yeah, this is great in Bournemouth, let's keep things local and build it and see how it goes? Or was it like, yeah, this is just stepping stones to get onto big bills down the line? Or was it like, or was it just fight by fight and see how this pro game goes?
Yeah, I think for me it was sort of a fight by fight thing, but I always had the dream of becoming, you know, Commonwealth champion, British champion, European champion, world champion. Like, that's always the dream as a boxer. I do think, and then Cyclone, it was good because obviously Cyclone had shows as well. And they were happy for me to box at home because it gives me another opportunity to get more experience. Earn some more money with ticket sales, and build me locally as well. So, and I think when you look at my career, I think it's been really done really well like that, especially that first four fights, because they were in 11 weeks of each other, which is unheard of for any pro really, let alone, you know, like we said before, someone who hasn't got a big name. But it would just happen to fall that there was a home show in Bournemouth which I could debut on. 4 weeks later, George Groves had his fight against Jamie Cox, and he had a slot on the undercard, and I was sort of the only person in the gym who was small enough to go in that in that slot in terms of experience. And obviously, me and George had done a lot of rounds together, and he sort of did me a favour there.
And you were in shape because you'd only just fought.
Yeah, in shape as well, and I was always in that position. Then 4 weeks after that, Josh Taylor was headlining against Miguel Vasquez on a Cyclone show, so I boxed on that card. And then 3 weeks after that, Cyclone had a card in Leicester. So I had four fights in 11 weeks, which, like I said, was just a dream start.
It's like the amateur days. All
yeah,
the
well, I boxed I boxed less as an amateur. I mean, I was having three or four fights a season unless I got to the final. I think that year was my busiest year at 8 fights. But yeah, four fights in 11 weeks is a joke. I was really happy about that.
So you got to 9-0 within a couple of years. You'd obviously had a few in Bournemouth. By the way, when you were here in Bournemouth and you were getting those positive crowd reactions, was it what you expected all those years ago when you'd seen them cheering for
my mate? Well, I actually had the realisation in my 10th fight against Richard Riakpor, because I'd sold 230 tickets, I think. It's on a Dillian White undercard at the O2, and
that was the Molina. No, was it
Rivas? Yeah, so it's White Rivas undercard. Me against Riakpor, 50-50 fight. I was the underdog going in, and I'm doing my ring walk. And just before my ring walk, I've walked out, and all my fans are in the same section, and they're all going Billum, and it was just electric. And I remember thinking on that ring walk, I was like, "This is why you started." Like, literally, I wasn't like an overwhelmed moment. I was just recognising, appreciating it,
yeah,
there and then. And I'm really glad I was happy to do that, because for me that was sort of like, I've made it in that sense, yeah, of why I started boxing.
Yeah, that part of the journey.
Yeah, part of the journey. I was like, okay, so like, it's like I've arrived. This is the big scene. These are big shows. This is, I've arrived sort of thing. And I just remember thinking at the time that what an amazing feeling that was. And I zoned in on the ring walk like I always do, felt very comfortable in there, and the fight went how it went. But I remember thinking, like, when 200 maybe more fans were chanting that, it was just
absolutely just electric, and I just remember really appreciating it. And my mate who was everyone was chanting his name was there, and it was just a real special moment. So yeah, it was great to realise that.
Scorecard's not so special. You lost a split decision. Where are you with that decision? Did you think it was right? Did you think it was wrong?
Not at the time. I didn't think it was right. I think the only issue I have with it is the knockdown, really. In terms of one had me winning, one had me losing, one had it 95-94, but that's only because of the knockdown, otherwise he would have had it a draw. So that the knockdown, I didn't think was a knockdown. He sort of hits me with a good left hook, and then I'm sort of just leaning back on the ropes, and he sort of pushes me over the rope, turn round and get up, and to see the ref counting, I'm like surprised. You can even see my reaction in the video, like, that's not a knockdown. And I was like, okay, well, you can't moan about it in that situation there, and then you've got to get on with it and try and do what you can. Plus, I thought at that point, after six rounds, I think I felt I'd won five of the six rounds, so then lost the seventh by two and thought I'd won one or two of the last three rounds. At the end of the ninth, I had him gone as well, and he was hugging me and rugby tackling me to the floor, and I'm like, if mine's a knockdown, then surely that is. So that's the only issue I have with that, not necessarily the scorecards themselves. You know, one had him winning, one had, it's one of those, it's my own fault for not making it clearer, and that's how I see my losses in close fights.
Did that fight get you signed with Matchroom?
No, I never signed with, obviously I boxed on their shows after on a fight by fight basis, but I'm grateful that obviously Eddie gave me the opportunity to then fight for the Commonwealth title, you know, albeit in a fight we didn't, like, Shane didn't really want me to take the Craig Glover fight. I'd sparred it six rounds in before, when they were down, their team was down on, what card was that on? David Price was fighting on a Joshua undercard, I think. I'd sparred Craig Glover then six rounds, felt comfortable in there with him. And I remember Shane saying then, like, he's a hard fight for a title because he's smaller gloves, one of the things, he comes forward and throws a lot of shots and he's a good fighter. And I agreed, but believed that I'd beat Craig if it was to ever happen. And then Shane said, Shane didn't really want me to take the Riyadh, or didn't want the Riyadh fight, but we sort of got forced into it because Chamberlain wouldn't take a fight with me. I can't remember who else, but maybe Luke Watkins didn't want to fight at that time either. And the Dion Juma fight had been offered, but the purse bid would have been my lowest career payday for a 10-round English title fight. It was like ridiculous, so I was happy to take it for that money, and obviously your management do their job, I guess. So we took the Riyadh fight, and it was what it was. So then the Glover fight was similar in terms of not Shane didn't believe in me, but it's too much risk versus the reward. But obviously the fight went how it did, and after that it was Matchroom every show, which I'm very grateful for, and great opportunities, and sitting now as British Commonwealth and European champion, thanks to Matchroom, the opportunities that they've given me.
Yeah, so things were never the same again after the Glover fight, because your next fight was in Fight Camp against Nathan Fawley. That was the first go-round of Fight Camp, so the no fans one. Mm-hmm. Was that a bizarre experience in reflection? Obviously, I know that we're a lot further down the line with the pandemic, but no crowds at Fight Camp, that first one.
Yeah, I think I said it a lot at the time as well. I think because you know there's no fans, you mentally prepare yourself for that. The stage and everything is set up, the ring walk's the same, it's just without your fans cheering. But I'd actually had an experience before fighting in front of no fans on my second fight when I boxed on George Groves' Cox undercard. And I'd done my ring walk without any music. The doors were closed, so all my fans, we were promised that they'd be open, even though it says doors 6 p.m. I was on at 5:45. I'm like, no, it'll be fine, it'll be fine. and then
it wasn't fine.
No, it wasn't fine. So I was in the ring, my name was announced, and then I just hear this crowd just run in and start chanting random, much like, "Go, Chris," and all this. So,
as you do, you can pick out when it's quiet, you can pick out the individual.
Yeah, yeah, literally, I can remember.
Bloody people, kill him.
Yeah, I remember thinking, oh, that's my mate Lau, or that's whoever. Yeah. And certain people I remember hearing. But I found out after that they'd actually have to push through security because they weren't letting them through.
Wow. Yeah.
And they heard the ring announcer.
Yeah.
And just ran in. So, yeah, it was... that was I used that experience in fight camp because I had it and it was slightly different. At least I was prepared for it this time.
Yeah, sure.
At least this time I got my ring walk properly as well.
Hey, so a lot of people in professional sport these days, they talk about lows and come downs from, you know, whether you've been fighting on the big stage or you've had a high profile fight and then sort of you go back to civilian life on the Monday. Do you find that hard, the ups and downs of being a professional athlete, where you have these incredible highs that won't be replicated in any other form of or part of your life?
Not really, because I'm so fortunate to do what I do. Like, I think coming from such a small town, my family are all working class people. The level I'm at, I've never seen in Bournemouth, you know, with the sort and the opportunities that I've been given and the situation I'm in. My dream as a kid was to be a professional footballer. And then as I grew up from my teenage years, you know, you'd be at Christmas and my family would be saying, you know, oh, what are you doing? I don't know, I'll be involved in sport some way, because they knew I would be. They'd be like, oh, you'll be involved in sport, because that was just what I was as a kid. So to be a professional athlete is I'm living my dream. So I'm very fortunate to be in that position. So I try and be grateful for that when any lows come. And there's been lows in my career where I haven't been boxing how I want to be boxing in earlier stages, or financially I wasn't okay from certain situations and stuff like that. But I think on a whole, I've kept very grateful to be doing what I am doing.
You had a hard fight with Vasyl Dukar in Wembley, didn't you? That was harder than advertised. It certainly wasn't one that I was anticipating. But you knew he was going to be hard. I think I spoke to you after that fight, or maybe even before, and you were sort of... I wondered whether you were just talking it up as fight week fight talk, saying, no, he's a tough dude. But you knew he was going to be tough, didn't you?
To be honest, in the ring, I felt like the fight went how I expected it to. Watching it back, maybe that I let way too many shots through. But I knew he was going to be tough, and I was really pleased with, you know, I dropped him twice, which I don't think anyone else had done. And he'd been in there with some good names like Egorov, who was obviously meant to be boxing for the WBA world title. And I'd seen him knock out people 14-0 as well on clips. So I was aware of the dangers. And obviously Maris Bredis had him out sparring when I was out there. So I knew it was going to be tough. But a points decision, you know, was sort of expected. But at the same time, I'm always, every fight I have, I try and do better than anyone else has ever done to that fighter in any way, shape or form. So... doesn't always work out like that, but you try and do that, and you try and just push your limits, and you see how other people have done against them, and try and do a better job. But I was hoping to be the first person to stop him, but it wasn't to be.
And then you had another tough, high profile, close fight with Tommy McCarthy. That was in the second go round of fight camp. There were fans at this one. I was there. Good fight, close fight. Some controversy, but then it depends on which side of the camp. I think the Irish people thought it was controversial, and your fans thought that you probably narrowly nicked it.
Yeah, I mean, we had me up in the corner by... I felt really comfortable in that fight as well. especially the pace of it. Like, I felt fine. I felt... He was getting the eye-catching shots through, but all the work was being done by me. I was forcing the fight. It could have been a boring fight if I'd allowed it to, but I think most people know I don't do boring fights. So, if I just
box like he boxed, then it would have been really boring. But I forced the fight, and I think that's where I was making mistakes, by forcing it too much, wanting it too much. The British title's on the line, the European's on the line, so very prestigious belts. And I think it was just one of those where I just maybe tried a bit too hard at times. But I feel, watching it back, I felt definitely it's the right decision.
And then you did 12 rounds in Sheffield in November. So you had three fights last year, which was great, given obviously the obstacles that everyone was facing. By the way, I mentioned about Shane at the start. What did he see in you? Shane actually said you were a breath of fresh air in boxing, as a nice guy, and you were enthusiastic and keen. One thing I did want to question, though, is where did the gentleman tag come from? Is that you?
No, that's from Shane. Maybe I just said... Met him at the right time, caught him in a good mood, and was, I don't know, politer than his other fighters. And then he came up with a nickname. We were trying to think of a nickname. I didn't have it until about my fourth or fifth fight. But that was Shane.
If you need these through dark guys here to make you a tux.
Yeah.
A through dark tux for a ring walk, that would be legendary.
Obviously, they've done my last few kits, so we'll have to sort something out.
And in terms of moving forwards, what do you need to do to improve as a fighter? Are there certain things that you want to work on that you think, you know, I need to improve that? When you see yourself go back 12 rounds and stuff, you're like, that's a particular area that I want to focus on. And do you give that to Shane, or does Shane say to you, or is it a collaboration?
We talk. We don't necessarily sit down and watch fights here, but we talk. Like, I need to work on this. And me and Shane have got a really good chemistry in that sense. I'll say something, he'll go, yeah, and he'll say something which I'm thinking. And that's how we work all the time. And even when someone else is sparring, then I'll be watching them, and I'll say something that they need to say something that I think they should try out, you know, now and again. Or after the spar, try and do this one. Like, yeah, that's what Shane was saying.
Yeah.
Like, so I think I've learned a lot off Shane, boxing IQ wise. So I think we click really well. So I think for me, though, it's consistency in terms of throughout the fight. There's too many periods where I'm making mistakes and I'm not controlling the round enough.
Are you switching off? Or are you...
It's not switching off. It's just, I don't know what it is in terms of... It's almost like a concentration thing, yeah. I think, sometimes. I think the consistency of concentration. So I guess it is switching off in a way, but...
Going onto autopilot more than
anything. Yeah, and maybe not switching off. Switching off in terms of, okay, I'm not going to be able to counterattack. I'm only going to be able to defend and hold because I'm not switched on enough. So I'm always in a position to... defend in turn when I do switch off as such, but I'm not in a position to always, you know, do something after that. I might just be, whatever it may be, just a little switch. So I think the concentration, consistency is the biggest thing, I think.
You've sparred some right lumps through the years, haven't you? And now you're in a camp with Okoli and Dubois. It's not an easy gig, is it?
No, I mean, I haven't sparred those two for a while now. I sparred Daniel before the first fight with Shane, and then he started getting really, really good, and I was like, Shane, I don't want to spar him anymore, because Shane was improving him. I'm sure we'll do rounds again, but Lawrence, obviously, I've sparred rounds with in the past. I've had some great sparring over
from
the years.
From the amateur days, right?
Sparred him, yeah, before he went, obviously, in my GB assessments, and also before he went to the Olympics, they got me and Chev in to spar him for sort of his last prep over here for Rio.
And you mentioned going over to spar Maris Bredas. So you went to Latvia?
Yeah.
So what was that like? Did they put you up in, like, there's one or two ways that I envisage this. They put you up in a 5-star hotel, they give you room service and all the rest of it, and then they get you out for sparring, you do your rounds and go back and live in a hotel. Or they put you in crummy digs and beat the crap out of you. Like, what is it? Is it one of those two or somewhere in the middle?
Thankfully, it was the first one. It was a nice hotel. Shane wouldn't let me go without a coach, so we took Josh Pritchard, Shane's assistant, with me, who's one of my best mates. And we had a right laugh, to be honest. It was cold out there. It was February. end of February, early March. I was out there for 1 week, and then I think after the second spar, they said, will you come back next week? And I said, sure, but... Well, they would say, will you stay for next week? And I said, sure, but I'm going to have to go home first because I had a commitment and Josh did too. So they booked our flight. We kept our flight home and then got a separate flight back again. So yeah, it was really good work. I was always the first one in for sparring. Jack Massey was out there. I think he was out there the first week. But yeah, when they, as you do when you bring sparring partners in, especially him, he had four. So the new kid who comes in will go in first because you don't know how good they are. So I got put in first, and then you always use the best one first because you don't want them going in fresh when you're tired. So he did that. I mean, I went in first time, and they were really pleased with the work. And then they used me every spar.
You find Vridis?
Very good, yeah, very good, very consistent. And I think I learned a lot about world level by sparring him. He was just consistent with everything: his punch power, his work rate, his punch output. Like, everything was consistent when I was sparring him. But at the same time, I made him work because that's the fighter I am. I think I was forcing him to fight at a pace higher than he likes, in terms of, like, because I'm a fast puncher and I do have a good high work rate, which I can keep up, yeah, and I can maintain it. Against him, it's slightly different, being able to maintain it when I hadn't had the rounds as such. So yeah, he'd do four rounds of me, and then the others would jump in, and then you could see the work rate difference between.
Is it hard to pick a winner between him and Lawrence?
I think at the time it would have been. I do think age is catching up with
Vridis.
I think. I don't mean in a sense of, like, he's getting old, but I think the mindset has changed. I think he's earned good money. He's achieved what he's wanted to achieve, and that's why some people like Mayweather, Bernard Hopkins can do what they did, because they had the same mindset throughout. And I think that is what age is. I think age is a mindset in terms of what they want to achieve. And I think Vridis is—he's not bothered about unifying because he's pretty much done it. Or I can't remember if he officially did it in the end with the WBO ruling, or if he'd done it before then, or whatever. But
winning the Super Series, he didn't.
The IBF was on the line,
exactly.
And was that it? Just the IBF?
Yeah. Because obviously Usyk was the one who cleaned up there.
Yeah, so he obviously had a good, great fight with Usyk himself, Vridis, he's been in all those 50-50 fights and hard fights, fighting the very best in the world. Now, does he want to do it again, or does he want to fight Jake Paul and cash out, which he's put up a few times? And I think he even called out Canelo as well more recently, as soon as Canelo says he's moving up. So for me, I think that shows a different type of mindset. And I know Lawrence's mindset. Lawrence is hungry as ever. He wants unification. It's like, he'll achieve one goal, European champ, or British Commonwealth. Went to European to world now wants to unify, and that's just how Lawrence is. He's so driven, and he's great to have around the gym because he's got a real elite mindset, and I think that's the difference. I think Lawrence would be so hungry going into that fight, and Vridis, even if he trained in the same sort of manner, I think there'd be something missing. And also, Lawrence is hard to beat. He's never looked in trouble. He's never looked like he's going to get beat by anyone. He's never looked hurt in a fight or anything like that. And I think that's where people don't give him enough credit, because he was boring maybe in the past. Now he's not. He doesn't get enough credit because he's not in close fights. And sometimes you get more credit for being in close fights.
He was just judged forever off two fights, wasn't he?
Of course, the Askin and the Chamberlain fight, yeah. But now look at him since then, and I think he hasn't even looked anywhere, you know, near getting beat, and I think that's what gives him an edge.
Your list of sparring things, or the guys that you sparred, is impressive, because there was also Bawatsi as well, which you can add to the list.
Yeah.
That stuff's got to have brought you on as a fighter. Well, you say obviously going away and Vridis has, and you've seen you, but to have had the sparring you've had, you know, Groves, Hay, Akoli, Vridis, Bawatsi, doesn't get much better, does it?
No, I mean, I've got superb sparring.
And have you learnt more from sparring than fights?
Yeah, what? I'd say so. Especially with sparring with Lawrence and Breedis, I think that brought me on a lot. George, obviously, at first, brought me on huge.
Have you ever had a sparring session that's crushed your confidence, or have they all sort of helped make you what you are?
No, sometimes it's the... You get an amateur in, and it's this... I remember a sparring kid from Earlsfield who... He was like an 81-kilo kid, but he was a typical Earlsfield fighter. He'd just move his feet, like Joe Joyce used to, like... Bum, 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 just not stop fighting. So, like, you try and move, and then he's just constantly throwing at you. But I was a pro then, and I was learning to sort of sit and just plant my shots a bit more. And even if you, like... He was lighter than me, so I couldn't really like whack him, and I was taking it slightly.
Take liberties.
But the work rate, and I was like, I can't stand sparring that kid. Like, I'd never want to spar him again because although in a professional ring, I'd get the better of him. One, I'm a lot heavier and everything, and the experience, everything. But I just, he'd come in for three rounds and just, or two or three rounds and just, you know, it was horrible. And then you go away and just think, what if I can't? If I can't deal with this kid who's a 15-fight amateur, how am I going to beat this person who's a professional and champion in this? But
you ask yourself a lot of questions, don't you?
You ask yourself those questions, and then you get the feedback from Shane and other people, and you say, look, like, this is this kid, this is his style, he's an amateur. Like, if you got him in fourth or fifth round, then it would be a lot different. He wouldn't be throwing that many punches.
Not every spar is a 10 out of 10.
Exactly. And I was flat that day anyway. So I'd sparred a couple of other lads and I was flat that day. But yeah, you get a couple of spars like that and you think, I think probably I had one before the last fight, the Breslin fight. And I was like, it was another amateur kid. And it's just like, they're just... Just the style is so different, the intensity.
What about, is it partly mindset as well? So you sparred all these top names and then you get an amateur and you're like, oh, I've got this.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe it is
that. And then you've got a complete matrix that you're not ready for.
Yeah, maybe. I think you almost get more nervous about sparring the lesser known amateurs and fighters than you do against, because you know what to expect.
And also they want to make their name inside.
Of course.
Or you're wondering if they do.
That's their world title fighting in that sense. Exactly. So, it can be really frustrating sometimes, but I've learned to deal with that now.
So tell me about your podcast and the highlights that you've had since you've been doing it. Because how long's it been going now? I know you've had a couple of series.
Yeah, I mean, this is the second series now. It wasn't going to be series. It was going to be ongoing, but COVID hit and time
hit.
It's
tough to stay on top of a podcast.
Exactly. You know it is. So I wanted to try and do one weekly, which was way over my head because it's not my full-time job.
Yeah,
it was just something I wanted to do on the side. So yeah, obviously Perfect Athlete podcast. I think I've recorded 14 episodes, 12 have been released. It's been brilliant. Like, I'm so interested in human performance in general. So whether that's the nutrition, the breath work, obviously I had a breath work specialist on there, the sleep, hence why we're wearing Whoops, and the sleep, track your sleep and everything, and then the athletes in different sports and trying to almost pick their brains for anything I can use. First one I ever did that got released was Scott Mitchell, who's a darts player. So that was the whole idea of the Perfect Athlete podcast, was every sport, they're athletes in their own right, and I thought nothing says that more than darts, because people look at them like they're just pub people who throw some arrows. But the mindset they have to have to... I mean, for me, darts would be really boring because it's the same motion consistently. Think about the training for darts. It looks great on TV when it's the crowd there at Ali Pally and everything, but when they're just playing on their own, constantly hitting... trebles, doubles, whatever, like, that's an elite mindset in itself, because the monotony, for me, I'd struggle with, and I thought that is elite in itself. And Scott actually had diabetes as well, so he has to control when he eats for his concentration levels. Obviously they sometimes get drug tested for beta blockers to keep him calm and stuff like that, so there's a side to it which people don't know. That episode was called 3-Pint Performance, because Scott said 3 pints is his limit. If he goes any more, he's too gone. But if he doesn't have any, he's too nervous. So that was his
his calming influence of the beer was the calming influence.
Have you taken that with you now?
Unfortunately. I mean, I don't think it works in boxing. That's one of the things I haven't taken. That was, and I actually went and watched Scott in the first round of the World Championships. Unfortunately, he didn't get through, but it was his first ever PDC World Championship. So for me, that was really cool to see. After we'd done the podcast, he got onto the World Tour and went to the World Championships. So that was cool as well. But yeah, some wicked highlights in it.
Anyone that you've interviewed that you've implemented something that they've done into your own routine or life? Or strategies. So I did think, just in terms of if you're struggling to reach on the spot, whether it's sleep, recovery, nutrition, preparation, nerves, or psychology, is there anything that you've heard that you've been like, I'm nicking that?
Well, I had my nutritionist on there, so obviously he's constantly on me, and we're always working together, trying to get 1s and 2% out of human performance or tracking where I'm at.
It's funny. Let me give, buy you some time there. When you talk about 1 and 2%, do you know what I think about this in boxing? I think about Anthony Joshua and Andy Ruiz, and how Joshua has been. He's sort of been quoted as saying he's looking for that extra 1 or 2%. I think when he was doing something with Under Armour and their sleepwear, he was talking about like maybe it was a marketing thing from Under Armour, like an extra percent or an extra 2%. The thing is, in boxing, it's such. You know, the punch is such a leveler. Whether Joshua trained like Rocky Balboa in, you know, Rocky IV, or whether he woke up in silk pajamas, it didn't really matter at the end of the day. And whether Ruiz had been, you know, he had late notice, probably hadn't been living the life, you know, never really has, and he just went out and chinned him. It's extraordinary that you guys can make these incremental changes, but just get leveled by one punch. That doesn't matter if you've got an extra 1 or 2%. It's not like a sprint where you're trying to get, you know, a tenth of a second off, or you're shaving 0.001 second off. This is something where you can leave nothing to chance and still get caught, and caught by someone who's not taking it anywhere near as seriously as you. And that's it.
Yeah, but if you didn't do the 1-2%, you'd regret it.
Sure.
It's given you everything.
And it's given you that confidence going into it as well.
So say those 1-2%, you know, on top of the 95% you're already doing or whatever it is, then, or 95, you've got to keep the main thing the main thing. And as long, and it's those 1-2% are just adding to get to that next level. But like you said, that's boxing. And with that fight, there was a lot of stories going around about issues in the change room, whether they're true or not. Don't know, but if they are true, then something got missed out. So that's a large percentage got missed out, whether that's the psychology factor, the maybe the routine was different, so the consistency wasn't there in one way or another, because he may have gone into that fight feeling different than he ever has from any other fight, which is why I think it is his dad who wanted him to pull him out or something like that. So if that is true, something was wrong. And a percentage was missed out. So those 1-2% didn't even matter. Because if you're not doing, if you're only doing 50% everywhere else or 60% everywhere else, and you're ticking off all these boxes to get up to 60%, those 1-2% only matter when you're at 95%, 98%. They don't matter when you're at 50%. So you've got to keep the main thing the main thing. I think that is always something, you know, boxing's got to be the forefront of everything. That's why we punch every day. And I'm not missing punching sessions to go and lift weights, or missing punching sessions to go and run, or missing punching sessions to go and sleep. The main thing stays the main thing. And I think for me, that's, like I said, those 1-2% are on top of everything, and they only matter at the top end. They don't matter when you're 50, 60, 70, 80% even. You know, they only matter when everything, every other box is ticked.
I've seen quotes saying that you want to start and finish your career with the McGuigans in your corner. They've been painted a certain way in social media from certain factions or groups or people, whatever you want to say. Why do you want to be with the McGuigans when other people have an anti-opinion of them?
You can only judge people by how they treated you. I think
if you look at my career, where I was without them, I would not be European champion. And I think even if I'd gone, you know, there's only very few gyms that could have got me to this level in the country, if any others. The work they've put in, but also the relationship I've got with them as people beyond boxing, you know, the family. I've been to Shane's brother Jake, his wedding, you know, things like that. I was at Nika's funeral, you know, I was there for personal things as well, because we get on well. But the job they've done me from a professional point of view is superb. Like, I'm 15 fights into my career and I'm Commonwealth, British and European champion. For someone who hasn't been to the Olympics or anything like that, that's pretty much unheard of, to be that soon in your career. You get other people with no amateur background or anything that go into the sport and then they become a world champion after maybe 30, 35 fights. But, you know, they've had their ups and downs. But after the 15 fights, to be in the position I'm in is unheard of. So I think the job they've done with me from a business point of view as well, as well as personally, it can't be argued.
Do you get abuse for being with them sometimes on social media?
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think about that?
They hear one side of the story. They don't know both sides of the story they're getting told. They only know one side. And they don't know my story, which is the most important thing. I don't... You get always the remarks of, oh, watch your pockets and things like that, with watch your pockets with Barry around, stuff like that. I've been paid very well, looked after, career's in great position, no complaints.
And Barry's been supportive. He's come down to the fights in Bournemouth and stuff,
absolutely,
hasn't he? Even the small fights.
Barry drove down here the week of my debut to do a release down here with BBC South Today and ITV Meridian. The time and effort, and that's gaining him nothing. Like, I don't think people understand, like, Barry doesn't earn any money, like, from doing that. And he's the same with everyone. Like, seeing him as a human being on a day-to-day basis, I took a young Irish lad down who used to live down here to the gym when I just started up there. And Barrett, and it was his, because it was his birthday, and I used to train with me a bit down here. And Barry gave him 50 quid. Like, that's who Barry is, you know what I mean? And anyone comes in the gym, he'll try and help them. And that's the sort of person he is. He tries to help people. And I don't think... Even the arguments maybe with Frampton stuff, I don't know what went on. I don't really care. That's sorted now. But at the same time, what I can, from an outsider's point of view, see is what a great career Carl had with them. So whatever did go on, went on. But he didn't lose all his career earnings. He didn't not win a title. You know, he won titles. He earned plenty of money. That's boxing. That's all you can ask out of boxing, pretty much. So, like I said, I don't know what went on. But for me, how they've treated me, how they've been around me, how I see them on a day-to-day basis, I've got absolutely no complaint.
When you say that's boxing, how does boxing pan out for you? Obviously, you want the big fights down here. You want them at Bournemouth Football Club for whatever reason. and is that the dream? Is the dream to fight there or to fight for a world title there? Or do you have other things in the bucket list? Obviously, Eddie has his fingers in so many pies in America. You know, he's talking about Australia. Do you want to tick other boxes, or is Bournemouth very much like this one that you're manifesting?
Yeah, I don't make too many long-term goals in boxing in terms of like... But I want to do this, then that, then this, then that, and that. Because you can't. Boxing, the whole landscape changes all the time. A fighter you want to fight next might retire tomorrow, but...
Or might get COVID the day before.
Or might get COVID, yeah, the day before, exactly. So, that's that. It's... For now, my mid-term goal is to fight in Bournemouth, and then my slightly longer term goal, my mid to long term goal then is eventually get a fight at the stadium. I think that's a dream. If I got offered a fight in Vegas or a Vitality Stadium, I'd take Vitality Stadium every day of the week, because it doesn't matter where, like, that's never been done. No one's ever boxed there. It's my hometown. So I used to go there as a kid.
Not even Freddie Mills.
Exactly. And to have a season ticket at that club when I was 12, 13, want to be one of those players on the pitch, not being able to because I didn't become a footballer, but then to be able to still live that dream in another universe by boxing on the pitch. And also the club have been great to me since I've turned pro. I've been done an evening with there just before Christmas and things like that as well. So it's home. You know what I mean? It's home. And I think nothing beats that for me. And it's such a surreal thing. I think, like I said, it's never been done. It may never be done again. Hopefully it will. Hopefully, you know,
becomes start, a boxing mecca.
Yeah, imagine Bournemouth the boxing mecca of Britain. But it's unlikely that, you know, it's going to be a hub for boxing because it's just such a small place. But to bring that to the town and give the people, the fans who have supported me down here, all the people I get, you know, people might be out on a run saying hello or whatever, that opportunity to come watch me in their hometown, that'd be just superb.
What happens in life after boxing? Have you got plans?
My wife's an interior designer and she has dreams of doing up houses and things like that. So I think that will sort of be an area where we'll financially be.
So invest in properties.
Investing in properties, yeah. And doing them up. I think it makes sense for us. And
have you got any of your dad's trade skills?
No, unfortunately, I'm the only one in the family. I've sort of let the family down when it comes to skills of trades. But my brothers have, so one's a chippy, one's a rigger, a scaffolder. So
okay,
they can do the house up, and I'll tell them where everything's got to go. But no, it's that. But I'd love to stay in sport, whether that's coaching or managing boxers or managing, like I said earlier about the podcast. I love all sports. So even if I was, I don't know, a sport agent of some sort of or anything like that, just to give opportunities to people as well from a rewarding point of view, you know, like I got a very big opportunity and I'd love to, and I believe I can help on more than just an agent standpoint. I can help on a performance standpoint as well, psychologically, and I know what makes a good athlete, one from the podcast, but two just from living it and always searching for new ways and studying athletes and different mindsets.
Also, you know, you said you talked off earlier about running 365 days this year.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen, is it?
Why is that?
Because you want to fight on certain days.
That's a good point.
And you're not going to want to do it. Well, you could make yourself do it a little bit the day before.
Like I said, 2 mile minimum. I didn't think about fight weeks at all. I think 2 mile minimum fight weeks are right. But I'll run after the fight. I'll run 2 miles after my fight.
Yeah, you don't want a 12-round.
Yeah, well, that's
12-round one where you're sat with ice packs on everything.
Yeah, well, that's my other goal this year is to. Last year I didn't get a knockout, so mine this year is only knockout. So hopefully that'll be easier and help me with my running goal.
One more for me, then I've got a couple of questions from subscribers. You've obviously done things not an easy way in the sense that, you know, we touched upon amateur career, we touched upon local fights to start and building and then pitched in early against Riyadpur in a tough 50-50 British Commonwealth European champ, even though you say it Commonwealth British European champ. It's fine, it's only because I'm older, so the British champ always used to go before the Commonwealth. You've done things the hard way, and this is a bit of a cheap question, but there are YouTubers out there making your money plus an extra couple of zeros on who've had 3 or 4 fights. Does that do your head in?
No.
Okay.
Because it's a business, it's not a sport.
Sure.
They're bringing in that business. I'm not bringing in that business.
Okay.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. Hopefully it gets give to it that, time. Those time. Numbers. But if they do want to fight me, I'm up for it. I'm up for it.
Is this you calling out Jake Paul?
But no, I think people forget that. I think they get way too wound up. I mean, I saw the tweet of Belly who said, you're not carrying
the sport
yeah. Which is true. Yeah. He's not. I don't think he needs to be told that. I think he's saying that to create more...
To get people to buy it.
More people, to create more of a hype, which then ends up with more sales, which ends up with him more money in his pocket. He's a genius. Like he's a great marketer. He's a great businessman. The YouTubers and Jake Paul in particular. And I don't...
Do you think he can fight?
I think he fight a bit. I think he's, for the amount of time he's been doing it, I think he's done really well. And
what
I do
level
think
would you say he's at? Would you say he's area title level in this country?
Not. It's a hard one because he's only boxed a cruiserweight. Right?
So tough.
That's the issue, I think, is he's only boxed a cruiserweight, but he's like an 84, 86 kilo cruiserweight, which you wouldn't box a cruiserweight.
Yeah.
Could he win a southern area title or an area title? Probably. Probably. I'm not saying he definitely would beat whoever the southern area champion is. Apologies, I don't know, and I don't mean to offend you, but he's also putting in the hours, clearly, like he's doing all this stuff on YouTube, but he's also training.
Yeah.
He's got the time to, because of his previous, if you want to call it his previous business of YouTubing.
His career, yeah.
His previous career. He's got the time to, because he's earned enough money and he can invest in that, and he can almost, the hours he's putting in is there, and also it's concentrated with an elite coach a lot of the time. He's getting good people in who know the sport.
Mm.
So some people don't have that at area level and stuff like that. They have people who they've, amateur coaches that are doing it 2 hours, 4 hours a week.
Volunteers and stuff, yeah. Sure.
Exactly. So no, it doesn't annoy me.
Brandon Mitchell asks, you've built a solid fan base from Pool ABC, Bendel's small shows to being a top domestic attraction on Matchroom, yet you're still the quietest fighter on social media that comes to mind. Why is that? You have such strong ticket sales and fan base despite not self-promoting your whole life and camps on social media. What are your thoughts on social media and other fighters?
I need to be more on there, because then maybe my name would be bigger and there would be more zeros on the end of the purses, but It's not me. I see it has a place and you have to do it. And at the end of the day, it is a business and you do have to make money. But I just try and, just be myself. And I think social media is a good place if you use it for the right things. Twitter, boxing Twitter is a dangerous place. It's very easy to wind people up, which I've been doing a bit recently.
Ruthless.
But as long as I can keep it fun in terms of, for me, which it has been, you catch plenty of bait on there. But it can be a good place.
Norman Barton saves me asking this one. I like this. You're a natural cruiserweight. How does Canelo fare against Makubu? If Canelo sticks around at that weight, how do you beat him? So Makubu first. Good fight. Winnable for Canelo?
I think it's winnable. I think he's slightly older now. He's been in the game a long time. He's not. He hasn't got great footwork. And then he hasn't got a massive work rate. I think out of everyone, he's the easiest champion for Canelo. I think everyone else, I think obviously Lawrence is massive and just beats him.
Do you want Canelo here in Bournemouth?
Yeah, Canelo.
Would you rather have Canelo or Jake Paul?
Canelo at the O2 Academy, 900 people. I think he's too slick, and you've got to be quick with Canelo, and that's why he can go up the weights, because of his elusiveness.
Also, Canelo posted, before his last fight, he posted a picture of the scales, like 6 weeks out, and he was about 182 pounds. So he's clearly come down from something.
Has he? Or is he just walk around at that?
I don't know.
He's only about 190 max.
Yeah, exactly. But that's, when you've got the skill and that size.
But that, remember, that's not 10 pounds and, different, is it?
No, but also, he could make someone, with that money, like Mayweather did. He'll say, right, I'll fight you at 194 for your belt.
Well, that's the thing. And I think that's kind of how the WBC have made cruiserweight go down. I think if that fight happens, I think it happens at 190. I think Makabu can probably make that, and I think that's that's always been the plan through Canelo, the Mexican, and Suleiman had a conversation. Who knows? Maybe it'll end up being 190 for one fight, and then Canelo vacates. Who knows? But I think he beats Makabu too elusive. But I think to beat Canelo, you've got to have good feet and you've got to have quick hands and a good chin.
You mentioned Breedis, Canelo, 195.
I just think...
Is that a good fight?
Yeah, I think it is a good fight, weirdly.
Yeah. I mean, it shows
the measure of how good Canelo is, right?
Yeah, because
we're debating him beating cruiserweights.
Well, and this was the thing. So I called it a few months ago. I said that would be like his Roy Jones, John Ruiz fight. So he's in that was a bit unfair, though, because Breedis is, you know, obviously a better cruiserweight maybe than John Ruiz was heavyweight. Mm-hmm. But still, you know, that was that sort of parallel, because there's no way he's going to fight a big heavyweight.
No.
So obviously cruiserweight is the furthest you could, not maybe realistically, but, you know, the furthest one he can reach.
Yeah.
And pull down to him.
And McCubbins, he's 6'1", is he? He's not massive cruiserweight. He's not like Lawrence, for example. So you fancy it. I think Breedis, that'd be a great fight, but I wouldn't know how to call that one, because Canelo's so elusive, and like you think, well, you just bully him, but then you can't bully someone you can't hit, and but you've got to learn to put your size on them, and I don't think Breedis is that sort of fighter to dominate with his size. He dominates with his work rate and his strength, but not his size by imposing it. So I think, yeah, it's a tough fight, definitely a tough fight to call.
A good one here from Nick Taylor, last one. Chris, you're a really entertaining fighter to watch. My question is, as a well-supported fighter with a continually growing fan base, do you see it as a big risk, popularity-wise, to be fighting on a streaming service as opposed to being on Sky/BT? That's an interesting question, obviously, for many reasons, because people, you know, with Eddie's brand, Matchroom, the hype, it's been a real snowball of momentum with people, with it being everywhere. But obviously Sky's also got, not without its guarantees. Interesting question. Is it something that you've paid a lot of mind to when you've made decisions and signed contracts?
Yeah, I mean, we signed a 3-fight deal before McCarthy, probably for that reason. He probably wants to get a few fighters signed in. Eddie's been good to me, and I'm a loyal person in terms of opportunities. Not that I had any other offers, but at that point, because we didn't go looking, but it made sense, and the offer made sense, and that's all I've focused on, really, is I get what they're saying with the streaming service and stuff, but who knows, like, where it's going. I think you definitely would get more exposure on Sky, but I also think the production on the Matching production is second to none. I don't think anyone puts on a better production in terms of the show, how it's run, even in the arenas themselves, how they're run. I've been to numerous shows, and I think Matchroom do it best. So aesthetically, it looks good, but also behind the scenes and everything works properly. And you just don't know what you're going to get with other promoters if you haven't been there. So
if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, and like I said, it's made sense for me. Who knows what will happen with everything in the future of DAZN. Maybe Sky will take over again in terms, or it might not go well. They haven't got any marquee names I don't know if Dillian White and Joshua have still got the box office deals. I'm not entirely sure, but other than them, who they've had previously, they're now in the phase of having to build fighters, which is interesting. Whereas Eddie's sort of got all the big names in the world. So yeah, it just depends, I think, where you are in your career and what way you want to go.
And just in terms of where you are in your career, this is just for people who wouldn't be aware of this, but even though we're recording this down near Bournemouth, you've actually moved. So you've moved up to near Shane. So you're cranking things up a little bit now in terms of it's no longer training camps or going up there for weeks at a time. You've committed and you're living up there fighting full time.
Yeah, I mean, it half makes sense, but also it was half had to rent a place up there, because before we had free accommodation because we were in Kent and we were on Unicampus. Before that, I was just beginning my career. I was staying at Shane's or a place that they had for us fighters. But I'm so much more settled now. I've got my own place and my wife's up there with me. And yeah, it's just near the gym, so much more settled. But that's how it's got to be now. Everything's got to be more settled around everything else. And keeping the main thing, which is what I said earlier. And everything involved in my life, my wife, who's pregnant, and we're due in May. So now my baby's life has to be evolved around keeping the main thing, because if that breaks, everything else falls apart. And anything else on top of that crumbles with it. So me being settled and keep performing and keep winning and keep improving is what we've just got to keep working on, and having that base is crucial for that.
Nice one, Chris. Well, thank you very much for your time, mate. I really appreciate it. I'm glad we finally got it done.
Thank you. Cheers, Chris.
Thanks, mate. Nice one, mate.
Appreciate it.
Huge thanks to Chris Billam-Smith, and the best of luck to him for a big 2022 with Shane McGuigan and co. Massive thanks to the guys at Through Dark. As I said at the top, check out their brand and their kit. They're doing absolutely amazing things. Chris was as chatty and articulate as I'd hoped. And please also check out his Perfect Athlete podcast. I should have mentioned that at the start. It's a wonderful and enlightening listen. Please check out his podcast. It's something very, very different to what people might listen to on Boxing Life Stories. And you certainly get a different side of Chris on his own podcast. I definitely would recommend that you check out. Huge thanks to our sponsors, Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, they'll help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. And if you could, please rate and review this podcast where possible. And please, as I said at the top, please go to the Sports Podcast Awards and vote for Boxing Life Stories in the Best Combat Sports category. Rate and review this podcast if you possibly can on iTunes. It would be hugely appreciated. And we'll be back next week.